Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. An English mission to Japan arrives in 1613 with all the standard English commodities, including wool and cloth, which the English hope to trade for Japanese silver. But there's a gift for the shogun among them, a silver telescope. As Timon Screech explains in his latest book, The Shogun's Silver Telescope, God, Art, and Money in the English Quest for Japan, 1600-1625, there's a lot of meaning behind that telescope. It represented an English state trying to chart its own path as a Protestant country, denoting their support for science and a more open culture in the face of a quote-unquote more backward Catholic Europe. Screech's book charts the background behind this simple gift and what it meant for both Japan and England as they tried to build a trading relationship. Professor Timon Screech is professor at Ichibun Ken, or the International Research Center for Japanese Studies in Kyoto, after 30 years at SOAS. He is the author of at least a dozen books on the visual culture of the Edo period, including perhaps his best-known work, Sex and the Floating World, Erotic Images in Japan, 1700-1820. His other most recent book, and previous interview subject on this podcast, was Tokyo Before Tokyo, Power and Magic in the Shogun City of Edo, published by Reaction Books. In 2019, he was elected as a fellow of the British Academy. Today, Time and I will follow the English journey to Japan, the reasons for these trips, and what the English encountered when they got there. And we'll think about what we learned from this ultimately failed effort to start a trade relationship between these two islands. So, Timon, hello again. Thank you again for joining us on the show. First question, why were the English interested in Japan in the first place? How were they hoping to find their niche in European trade with Asia?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you for having me back onto your show. It's a great pleasure to be invited once and a great honor to be invited a second time. So the history of European trade with Japan obviously begins decades before the English showed up. The English were very late to the game. It had been the Portuguese who came first to agree to the Spanish, and then the Dutch, and the English are the kind of last ones to arrive. And that means that the English have to demonstrate to the Japanese why they're different. It's not just another Western country turning up, asking the same old, trying to get the same old things, selling the same old objects. English were going to be different. That's what they thought. But why they sent the ship was that the English had already been trading fairly successfully to Southeast Asia, buying spices. And I think your listeners will all know about the English East India Company, which would turn into a very rapacious and in some ways quite a repellent organization. But in the early days of its foundation, in the very beginning of the 17th century, it was pretty benign and small, and a rather frightened body of traders that were sending little tiny ships a long way away in a sometimes vain hope of making profits, but they wanted spice. And spice was a way to make rather insipid North European food more tasty, but also it was regarded as having medical qualities, and especially nutmeg and the membrane inside the nutmeg called mace, which was the world's most valuable commodity at the time, thought to cure plague. And we can think that the head of the East India Company himself, one of the richest and most powerful people in England, died of the plague in 1625. So it was a very, very topical matter to be able to protect yourself from that. And selling spices, buying spices on Java, which much cheaper than buying them in Istanbul or even in Venice, made the trip worthwhile. And having done that for the best part of a decade, the English East India Company think to themselves, you know, we're pretty well established in Java, our ships are going that far. It shouldn't be too much of an effort just to go further up to Japan. And so they began proposing to do that. And the company, having been founded in 1600, first sailing happened in 1601, and the first sailing to Japan was dispatched in 1611, a decade later.
So could you tell us a bit more about the state of the English at this point in time? Obviously, they're far from the dominating world power they'd eventually become. How do they see themselves, and how do they see themselves in relation to Europe?
England was a somewhat tremulous entity at the time. English people are brought up on these stories of Elizabeth I and Drake and wonderful activities on the Spanish Main and capturing Spanish silver ships, and these stories are to extent true. But with the death of Elizabeth I, which happened shortly after the creation of the East India Company, and the coming of James the Sixth of Scotland came down to be James the First of England, there's a realization England has to move into a different sort of way of behaving. It's not good enough to keep stealing Spanish silver. King James regards himself as a peacemaker, and he opens talks and creates a peace with Spain fairly early on. So the English are going to have to become a proper modern style trading nation. And what they got from the Spanish in warfare was silver. And all countries needed silver for all kinds of purposes. They can continue to get Spanish silver, but they're going to have to buy it in future rather than stealing it. And that interferes with their balance of trade. So they start looking for another place where they can acquire silver, hopefully at a lower price and possibly even purer than they got from Spanish colonies. And Japan was exactly such a place. Japan had copious amounts of silver, and although they were widely trading it internationally already, on the whole, the Japanese were selling their silver more cheaply than you could get it in other places, and it was worth traveling all the way from London to Japan to get silver. No longer being able to steal it, they would have to buy it. They'd have to buy it with something, and what they choose to send is the main English internationally recognized export product of the period, which was woolen cloth. And English woolens were in fact already being sold in Japan by the Portuguese and the Dutch when they arrived. Japanese knew about woolen cloth, but they had no sheep in Japan, so they didn't produce their own. And the English have high hopes that this will be a very lucrative trading arrangement and beneficial for both sides.
And Japan, too, I think, is different from how we would normally, or at least how maybe our mainstream understanding of Japanese history, in a very shallow one, would suggest. I mean, the mainstream narrative of Japan is that it was closed off before being, you know, pried open by Commodore Perry. But your book reminds us that wasn't always the case, if it was always the case.
Japan was in a state of civil war for almost the entire 16th century. It's kind of mind-boggling that a country would be at war for so long. And during the course of that period, there was massive destruction. There were, every boy was being dragged off to fight. Every woman was losing her male support. And every building was burnt down. And many local warlords began to see international trade as a way both to fund themselves and to gain legitimacy. The Spanish and the Portuguese were in Japan to take silver and also, it must be said, to take slaves. But they also wanted converts. And if a warlord would convert, then they would ensure a supply of guns and gunpowder and give also legitimacy, fight under the sign of Christ, and your fight is good and legal. So the civil wars of Japan, which had begun before the Europeans arrived, probably were exacerbated by Iberian interventions. But there's a massive battle in the year 1600, easy date to remember, when Tokugawa Ieyasu, who is the shogun named in the title of my book, won an enormous victory and effectively became de facto ruler of most of Japan. Japan, of course, is a very long archipelago, and hardly anyone controls the whole thing until modern times. But he got the main chunks, which would be Edo, modern-day Tokyo, Osaka, Kyoto, and some important outlying islands. And 3 years after this victory, he had the emperor, who's a rather puppet figure, create him shogun. There hadn't been a shogun for a few decades, and there hadn't been a powerful shogun for about a century. So he really changes, or you might say restores, the Japanese state. And Ieyasu was extremely interested in international trade. The idea about Japan being closed off is, it's an exaggeration at any time in history, but certainly the early 17th century when Ieyasu was recently created shogun, it's a very international period. However, there was concern, like in many countries, that international trade is one thing, but missionaries converting your people is another matter. And the fear that Roman Catholic converts would end up being more loyal to Rome than to the new shogunate was a genuine fear, and may well have been a well-placed fear. There are rumors, and there are even some hidden documents suggesting that the King of Spain was not at all averse to the idea of using Japanese Christians as a way to overthrow the Japanese state and include it into his empire. He never tried, and if he thought about it in cool terms, he probably realized Japan is not going to be a place that can be conquered like Mexico or the Philippines. But nevertheless, there was concern at the Japanese side that trade is fine, but conversions need to be watched over with a degree of care and alarm. And of course, the Japanese were also increasingly worried about the loss of silver. They needed it themselves, and vast amounts of silver leaving. And of course, they were deeply offended by Japanese being taken away as slaves. So this is the kind of the state into which the English arrived, with the Iberians having already traded for a few decades, and the Dutch, who arrived in 1609, so only a couple of years before the English, were established themselves too.
We'll get into, I think, the kind of the religious politics of Europe and how that affected Japan later in the interview. But you mentioned the missionaries, and it sounds like the English in Japan were somewhat involved in some of these whispering campaigns about the missionaries, or at least the English thought they were. I think you note, what is it? One of the English traders being hurriedly called into a late night meeting to share more about the Guy Fawkes incident and things like that.
Yes, so the English that went in 1611 arrived in 1613. Of course, there was a commander that went to meet the shogun. Actually, technically, he was the retired shogun at that point, but he still controlled the country, Tokugawa Ieyasu, and received from him permission to trade, as he had given permission to the Spanish, Portuguese, and Dutch already. And that commander named John Saris returned to England, but he left to run the trading station a man called Richard Cox. And Cox is an interesting figure because he had no previous links to the East India Company, and people have wondered how it was that he got selected to run this quite sensitive and also potentially very lucrative post. He could expect to make a large amount of personal gain as well as money for the company. How did Cox get selected? And we can't quite answer that question exactly, but we can look at Cox's previous life, which is he worked as a wool merchant. He was experienced at selling wool, and that's what he'd be doing in Japan. But he'd worked as a wool merchant in Bayonne, which is, of course, the southernmost Atlantic port of France. And Bayonne was a good place to sell English wool because you could sell it from the French side up into the Pyrenees, where, of course, it's pretty cold in winter and wool should be very desirable. The English had poor relations, and early on they had no relations with Spain, so you couldn't sell wool from the Spanish side. But Bayonne had another function in the English government's mind, which, being the southernmost port of France on the Atlantic coast, it was also where illicit Roman Catholic priests from Spain would be embarked to come to England, which was, of course, completely illegal. Roman Catholicism in England had been not exactly outlawed, but Roman Catholics had to swear allegiance to the English crown, and they had to attend English church services, the Holy Communion, as distinct from the Roman Catholic Mass. It's a very intricate matter. And as a historian of Japan, I was a little wary at launching into too many comments about this moment of English history, which is so deeply researched. But the point is that Cox seems to have been employed by the East India Company because he was regarded pretty good at ferreting out covert Roman Catholics, and especially Jesuits. The English had a tremendous fear of Jesuits, who were regarded as responsible for the attempted assassination of King James I and the entire English government and episcopacy when they were all gathered in London on the 5th of of November, today still remembered as Guy Fawkes Day, because Guy Fawkes was the presumed ringleader. It should be added that modern day historians don't necessarily blame the Jesuits for this assassination attempt, which in any case failed. But at the time, the word Jesuit struck great fear into the English, and they were also convinced that as soon as they turned up anywhere where Jesuits were already operating, they would be vilified to the local rulers. So the English fully expected the minute their ship arrived, the Jesuits would start telling the Japanese that they were just brigands and hooligans and pirates and should not be allowed to trade. So Cox operated in Japan, running the trading station for a full decade. And indeed, the trading station, by the way, was in Kyushu, so very far away from the Japanese center of power. But he made a couple of trips to Kyoto and to Edo, modern-day Tokyo, where he certainly divulged what he regarded as facts of the wickedness of Jesuits.
So I'd like to pivot back to talk about the English East India Company. And you've talked about how it was far from the rapacious organization it became centuries later. I remember I was struck by, what was it? The story of is it, maybe I'm pronouncing his name wrong, but Saris, the person who did the first trip to Japan, who lands in England and seems to be constantly ignoring messages from his superiors to please make his way back to headquarters. And he's always delaying. He says, oh, the winds are bad. And the company just kind of is just like kind of crossing its arms and kind of being like, well, okay then. And then just, but it's very interesting kind of just to see the inner bureaucracies of this very new organization. So could you just go into a bit more detail about kind of the relations within the East India Company as an organization?
Yes, so the East India Company had, of course, its investors, wealthy people. Initially, it's restricted to English people. Subsequently, what they call strangers or foreigners who are living in London are also eligible to invest. And each voyage has its own investors, not just to Japan, but the ones which are simply going to Java, buying spices and back. And the problem with East Voyage having its own investors is that one voyage may benefit its investors at the expense of the others. So within the East India Company itself, voyages are in competition. So if you can get your voyage to buy up all the spices, for example, and dash back to London with them, your investors will be delighted. But the next ship that comes along will find that there aren't any spices sitting in the market ready to be bought. And eventually the company resolved this by creating what they called a joint stock, so that profits were evened out and regulated across the various sailings. Some voyage was fantastically lucrative. Some voyage, well, the ship might even be lost at sea and it's a pure loss. So that was from the London investing point of view. But of course, they also had to trust the commanders who were sent off in these ships, who had literally control of life and death over their sailors. They were negotiating in countries about which very little was known. They had to be given a kind of carte blanche to do what they thought was right. And those commanders were senior people who were risking their lives and felt it was completely legitimate for them to come back personally enriched as a result of this experience. And the company turned a bit of a blind eye to what they called private trade, but they didn't like the idea that individual commanders were making their own, you know, feathering their own nests at the cost of the company's profits. And when Saris sailed off to Japan and implanted Richard Cox to run the East India Company and came back, he was told, of course, he was going to get silver, principally speaking. But they did say to him, well, you know, there are other Japanese objects which we know will sell well, such as lacquer. Japanese lacquer was already highly valued in Europe. And also, to some extent, paintings, Japanese screens, beautiful paired screens often painted on gold. There were already some in the Vatican, and the King of Spain had a few. And so they say to Saris, by all means, bring some of these back if there's space in the ship. And he does. On his own bat, or possibly using company money, he purchases these things and brings them back. But then, as you intimated, when his ship arrived into Plymouth, reputedly, he started flogging off some of these things before the ship came around to London and the cargo could be properly inventorized, flogging them off to his own account, right? And we don't really know, but the company got wind of this and started intercepting his mail, and it appeared that Cyrus was not really doing what he was quite supposed to do. And he kept on saying, as you said, he said, "Oh, you know, I'm stuck in Plymouth. I can't. The winds are against me. I can't bring the ship around to London. So I'll just have to stay here for a little while." And having got the ship all the way back from Japan, including a period of loading spices on Java, I think that the trip back took him only about 9 months. He then spent 3 months supposedly bringing the ship from Plymouth around to London. Of course, the company was extremely suspicious about this. And then eventually they said to him, "Listen, you better come back over land and the ship can come in its own speed." But eventually, hearing this, Cyrus did bring the ship around to London. And the head of the East India Company, Sir Thomas Smith, gave him some pretty harsh words, and it appears that Cyrus backed down and said, "Oh, no, no, nonsense, all this lacquer, of course, I haven't kept any for myself, it's all going to be given to the company to sell." And and the company said, "Okay, well, that being the case, you actually have done an excellent job in opening trade with Japan." So they gave him a very generous kind of thank you gift of 500 marks, which was very, very large amount of money. And so Cyrus basically was rich anyway. The company got their goods, which they then sold. And indeed, Cyrus then retired. He never sailed again. He married a very wealthy heiress from the city of London, and they settled down. Unfortunately, his wife died rapidly, probably in childbirth, and he then retired to a country village outside London. We don't really hear much more of him again. But the result was that arriving on this first ship back from Japan was probably silver indeed, but the lacquer caused a considerable interest in London. And immediately after arriving in London, within only weeks, there was a lacquer sale, an auction in London. And interestingly, this is London's first ever art auction. Today, people think of Christie's and Bonham's and Sotheby's, and London is associated with international art auctions. But the first one ever, 1614 December, when the ship came back, was Japanese lacquer. And they sold it at auction, of course, because people didn't really know how much to market it for otherwise. And these items went for very significant sums. It wasn't just trivial exotica. They were hugely valued things that would have gone to elite people.
So talking about art, I mean, you spent a lot of time in the book talking about some of the paintings that the English bring with them on later trips to Japan. And they bring a lot. I think they bring, I think, a lot of Titians, or more accurately, maybe Titian derivatives, with them on their trips to Japan. I guess The short question is kind of, why were they so invested in bringing art to Japan?
It's a very interesting question, because when Cyrus, he's gone off to Japan in 1611, he meets the Shogun in 1613, he's back in Plymouth and then London by autumn 1614. The company was so excited about the options for trading in Japan that they sent the second and then the third ship to Japan before Cyrus had even come back. So it might have made sense to wait and hear his reports, but they didn't. And so they were relying on either things they'd picked up from the Dutch or from the Spanish and the Portuguese, with whom they have poor relations, but they can, spies can give information. Or they were kind of extrapolating from what they'd seen in other Asian countries. And if you think about it, the kind of things that the King of Poland or the King of Sweden or the King of Spain or the Grand Duke of Tuscany, the sort of things they would like are possibly rather similar, right? And so the English think, well, the thing that Shogun of Japan would like and the thing that the Mughal Emperor would like, probably they're about the same. And they had already established trade in India, and they had witnessed the fact that the Mughal Emperor, Jahangir, he's very well known in Indian history as an aesthete. He had a huge interest in painting. It's a great moment in Indian miniature work. But also, strangely enough, though he was, of course, an Islamic ruler, he was very interested in Western art and in Western Christian art, including in Christian themes which contradicted Muslim doctrine, such as the resurrection of Christ. So the English hear and directly experience that the Mughal court will absorb masses of art, and they think, well, surely the Japanese will do the same. And so they send off about 100 oil paintings on the third ship, which left somewhat before Cyrus got home. And those artworks were there were three sections, really. One was royal gifts from the King of England to the Mughal Emperor, so they were not going to go on to Japan. The second set were English portraits. They thought, probably quite rightly, that the Japanese rulers would be interested to know what English, you know, countesses and great ladies wore, their hairstyles, their clothing. And so a large number of portraits of English nobles were sent to go to India and to go to Japan to be given or sold to the Japanese opposite numbers who they thought would like them. And many of the sitters are named. It would be fascinating to know, did the sitters donate their portraits? Did they say, oh, you know, a countess of Rochester or something says, I want my portrait to go. Who knows? But in any case, these portraits went. And the third category were what the East India Company called lascivious paintings. And lascivious is a kind of intriguing word, right? What they appear to have been is what we would today call classical nudes. So the great establisher of the classical nude genre in Europe was the Venetian painter you mentioned, Tiziano. He was already dead by this point, but the models he'd set up of kind of, you know, Venus and Cupid and satyrs and Susanna bathing, his models were widely copied in Venice itself, all across Italy, and you could pick up a kind of knockoff Titian equivalent for not too much money. And when the East India Company decided to commission these lascivious paintings, indeed, they send an agent, not to Italy, that's too far, they haven't got time, they send an agent to Rouen. And Rouen was the main French international port. It was the only French port that was allowed to bring in trade from non-European countries. So Rouen, of course, is rather inland, but sailing ships can sail that far in. And so they go and they buy specifically Venetian paintings in Rouen. And they come back with about 50 of them, and we have the titles of most, which were indeed the sort of things attributed to Titian, but the prices make it quite clear they could never have been real Titians. They would have, it would be stupid to send a real Titian to Japan without yet knowing what the Japanese would think of it. But knockoff equivalents, which were in the price range of about £5 to £10, which is good art. It's not rubbish, but of course a Titian himself would have been much more than that. And these are sent off. And when Cyrus comes back to London in 1614 autumn and arrives in Plymouth, he hears this ship has gone, and he said, you've absolutely hit the nail on the head. It's exactly what I would have told you to send. Just like the Mughal Emperor, the Japanese have a high understanding of art. They would be very interested to know about our Western paintings. And he may have said, although it's not recorded as him saying it, he may have said the Jesuits themselves have set up a Western art school in Japan, which is producing Christian art. So why don't we send some things telling them about our worldview too? Because Cyrus confirmed the Japanese would like this, the East India Company, but Cyrus said something else. He said that the Japanese also love paintings on themes of war. And the English had sent portraits and lascivious paint. They had not sent anything on the theme of war. So they dash off another sailing at the very end of 1614, even though sending out a ship in winter is a bit risky, with a large number of war pictures. They haven't got time to commission any, so they send war prints. And not oil paintings, but prints. And war themes were pretty easy to procure in London because the whole history of the Spanish Armada, the wars of the religion on the continent, you could buy these things in London, and they were bought and sent off in a little ship, which is supposed to speed and hopefully catch up with the one carrying the oil paintings, which indeed it does. The ship was called the Advice because the cargo had been put together on the advice of Cyrus, and it got to Java, where it met the ship carrying the oil paintings, because that ship had gone via India first, and they regroup there, and they put together what they think will be the perfect cargo for Japan, and that will be the third English ship to
arrive. So this is an interesting segue, because the book is filled with missed connections like this, you know, ships leaving before other ships can make it back with the goods they need or the information they need. The second sailing to Japan, or later sailings to Japan leave before the first sailings can make it back. People are waiting around for boats to arrive. The boat doesn't show up. They assume, well, I guess the boat sank and they leave. And then the boat shows up a week later. And so it seems like perhaps we're spoiled by our modern day, you know, instant communications and everything. But it kind of leads to the question, kind of, how did anyone communicate and actually run global operations at this point in time?
It's a very good question. And of course, we have to completely shed our understanding of certitude and business confidence and contract law, all those things, completely irrelevant. And they were probably irrelevant in any case. But when you're sending ships all the way to Asia, it was really quite a haphazard affair. Having said that, I'm actually quite impressed by the level of documentation that was retained. Regrettably, the East India Company archive is quite well preserved in the British Library, but it's lost. There's some chunks, you know, missing. And sending the first ship to Japan is precisely a moment where a chunk is missing. So we don't have details about how they thought up the cargo and how they selected Cox and Saris to lead. But there is a copious archive of letters sent back from the various ships, and every ship come. The Dutch and the English on the whole assist each other in conveying each other's correspondence, although, of course, they always steam it open and check what the others are saying about each other. But you don't throw somebody else's correspondence overboard. So they can rely on the Dutch to bring things back and forth to them. Things in India can come back over land. It's not impossible to send a courier from the Mughal court through Iran to Aleppo, where the English ships are sailing. There's also a English Turkey company sailing back and forth to Aleppo and to Istanbul. So things, curiously enough, do tend to get through. But we often have a letter which says, you know, as I refer to my previous letter, and the previous letter is in extant. So there was a lot lost. One slightly intriguing little episode is that ships tended to stop at the Cape, where today, of course, Cape Town, and they were stopping there to refuel or revictual, right, to take on water and meat and vegetables, and they didn't do a lot of trading there. But there they would inscribe stones. There was a thing called the post office stone, where a ship would you know, inscribe on a rock, we pass through at this stage, this is the name of our ship, these people are dead, this commander is now in charge, and people would pick up that over time. The number of ships lost is not so great, actually. And I think what's interesting about sailings is that once the ship is at sea, unless there's a really major storm, it's pretty safe. Ships tend to wreck when they are near to coasts, because that's where reefs and rocks and things are. So once the ship's kind of out of Plymouth, has got away, and if the food lasts, then they tend to be able to get to Java. And then from Java up to Japan is not so difficult. The English are not allowed to stop in the Philippines because that's Spanish, and under the Treaty of Peace with Spain, they're not allowed to intrude into Spanish areas. So they can't stop in the Philippines, but they can stop in what's today called Okinawa, then an independent kingdom called the Ryukyus, if they need. On the whole, they don't. They go straight up to Japan.
So we haven't talked as much about, in some ways, the other side of the story, which is the Japanese. You know, how do the Japanese receive the English? How do they receive the gifts they get? And how do they kind of see this, you know, island country on the other side of the world?
There's a kind of factor X, which I haven't mentioned yet, but I should mention it now, which is that the first Dutch ship that arrived in Japan, before the creation of the Dutch East India Company, it was a ship which sailed out of Rotterdam, and all the other ships were wrecked, and one sailed into Japan in 1600. It was piloted by an Englishman, and that's not so strange. English and Holland had very good relations, and so this fellow was called William Adams, and he remained in Japan from 1600 right through until his death in 1625. In the course of 25 years, he married, had children. He had obviously very good Japanese, and he became a confidant of the shogun Tokugawa Ieyasu. And Adams had fought, or rather he'd been in charge of a supply ship at the Spanish Armada. He knew firsthand, or he thought he knew, the wickedness and the danger of Spain and what the Jesuits put European Catholic kings up to, and how the Jesuits instigated regicide and such things. And he informed Ieyasu about that. It's pretty clear he did so. And this would have allowed Ieyasu to kind of triangulate what he was hearing from the Spanish. It's not that he believed everything Adams said and disbelieved everything the Spanish said, but by hearing two sides, he was able to come to his own views about things. So the English East India Company was vaguely aware that there was this English person already in Japan, having gone on a Dutch ship. And when Saris sails off 1611, arrives 1630, he's told to try and find this person, Adams, and ideally to enlist him to work for the East India Company, which indeed Adams agrees to do. So they have a very immediate and very valuable inroad into the shogun's court. And Saris turns up with this gift of a what the English call a silver, actually it's a silver gilt telescope. In other words, it looks like it's gold, but the material is actually silver. They often silver gilt things. Silver tarnishes very quickly, right? And gold is too soft. So silver gilt, the title of my book says a silver telescope because silver gilt telescope is too long. In any case, they give this object and the shogun is quite startled by it. He's obviously never looked through a telescope in his life before, what exactly he could see through it, what the capacity of an early 17th century telescope is possibly debatable. But of course, Galileo at this time was making his extraordinary discoveries to the telescope. In fact, Galileo's discoveries were known to the English just before they commissioned this beautiful telescope to send to Japan. So they're clearly sending off something which has the latest scientific and indeed military applicability. You can use a telescope on land for seeing where any enemy armies are doing. Anyway, the shogun's court record mentions the arrival of the English with this silver telescope and the fact that the shogun received it. And the Japanese archive also has a transcription of the letter that the shogun sent back to King James of England, thanking him for the telescope, in which he said, "I was amazed by this a present which I had never seen before and I never expected to see." So this object clearly had cultural value in Japan. It may very well have had military value. It could even have had some astronomical value. There's no record of the Japanese having used it to spot the heavens like Galileo did. I mean, Galileo could see that because he was extremely punctilious. Most people looking through an early 17th century telescope can't see a whole lot, but they can see an approaching army. So it's very likely the shogun used it in one of his subsequent battles, and possibly even it got broken in the course of that because it doesn't survive today.
So I had one more question. One parallel I made upon reading your book is with with the Dutch embassy to Beijing in Qing China, as covered in a previous Asia View Books podcast interview on Tonio Andrei's Last Embassy. And the reason why I made that comparison was that it's an effort to kind of woo one of these big Asian countries from a European nation that doesn't normally kind of feature in the mainstream history of or mainstream diplomatic history. It also wasn't successful, mostly due to events outside of the mission's control. And this approach to Japan kind of seems to also be like that. It's a mission from a country that doesn't quite feature in the mainstream diplomatic history about Japan, which is most about the Portuguese and the Dutch. It doesn't succeed, I think, mostly because I think events happening in Europe, the company decides to focus more on India, I believe. But I guess kind of to kind of end the interview, is there a way that these missions could have turned out differently? And what can we learn from England's efforts to woo Japan?
It probably couldn't have turned out differently because they were operating under some misconceptions. First of all, they went to Japan to sell wool, and they were aware that English wool was being sold in Japan, and they were aware that Japan has no sheep. Therefore, Japan was not itself a wool-producing country. They think, well, we'll sell lots of wool. But it hadn't kind of occurred to them that the Japanese had no wool. It's true. But the Japanese already had perfectly good winter garments, which they'd been wearing for centuries. And it wasn't obvious that wool was better. In fact, some of the English traders, when they get to Japan the first winter, they start wearing Japanese winter garments because they find them nicer than the wool. And the Japanese say, you're not even wearing them yourself. How do you expect us to wear it? Secondly, bringing wool all the way from London in a wooden ship is a pretty difficult enterprise because water leaks in, there's salt air, much of the wool arrived rotten, it couldn't all be sold. But there was a third misconception, which was the whole idea about sailing from England to Japan via the Cape of Good Hope and India and Java was intended to be a short-term option. I think all your listeners have heard about the Northwest Passage, sailing to Asia from Europe through what they thought was a sea. Today we know it's the Hudson Bay. You can't get through the Northwest Passage over America. But the Northeast Passage over Russia was also very much explored by the East India Company for the good grounds that there were some friendly Russian cities along the north or towns, and they thought it's much better than sailing through Canada where there's no friendly metropolis. So the East India Company thinks that they will sail from London to Japan and back over Russia, dramatically shorter, they believe, because they're not aware of the existence of Siberia. They think you just sail a little bit beyond Moscow and Archangel, drop down south, and there you get to Japan. They don't realize the seas are permanently frozen. So once they realize Siberia exists, therefore actually it's not that much shorter going via Russia. Secondly, the seas are unnavigable. And thirdly, the Japanese have their own perfectly good winter garments. Therefore, they don't want to buy English wool. Then they realize the whole thing doesn't work. And then they say to themselves, listen, you know, the Dutch and the Portuguese and the Spanish are bringing over Japanese silver. We can just buy it from them. There's no need to send our own ships. It makes me think a little bit of airline. You know, every country in the past used to have its own flag carrier airline. And even if they were hugely loss-making, you weren't a proper country unless you had your own airline. And it was the same. You had to have your own East India Company. But then they say, listen, we'll buy the stuff in Amsterdam. Why not? And the East India Company, as you say, puts much more effort into trade with India. That goes very well, one might say, possibly to the detriment of the Indians themselves. The East Indian Company becomes so strong and powerful in
India. So with that, thank you for listening to our interview with Timon Screech, author of The Shogun Silver Telescope, God, Art, and Money in English Quest for Japan, 600-625. Timon, I have one more question for you, and it's the question I end every interview with, which is kind of where can people find your work and what's next for you?
Well, I'd be delighted if your listeners choose to Google my name and the Shogun Silver Telescope, and the book is easily there to buy. It's with Oxford University Press that has pretty good worldwide distribution. It's currently in paperback. It's currently hardback, but I hope that enough purchases might encourage the OUP to put a paperback out, which will be much cheaper. But my next project, which I'm well embarked on now, is that the Shogun Ieyasu, having received his telescope, died in 1616. And his role in pacifying the country and ending the civil war was so enormous, and so people were so such gratitude to it, that he was deified. And so my current project is on the deification of Tokugawa Ieyasu. And today, this can still be seen. Of course, nobody today regards the shogun as a genuine god, but his main site of worship is at a town called Nikko. Today, you can easily do it as a day trip from Kyoto, from Tokyo, and his gorgeous mausoleum there has recently been restored at tremendous expense by the Japanese government. So I urge any of your listeners, if who are in Japan, to go to Nikko, and in due course, I hope they'll be able to read my book on that subject too.
Well, something to look forward to when we can all travel again. You can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at Nick R.I. Gordon. That's NickRiGordon. You can go to AsianReviewBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Facebook or on Twitter at Book Reviews Asia. That's reviews plural, and you can find countless other author interviews at the New Books Network at newbooksnetwork.com. The Interview Books podcast is on all your favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends if you want to continue to support us interviewing those writing in, around, and about Asia. Next week, join us for an interview with Elizabeth Lacouture, author of Dwelling in the World, Family, House, and Home in Tianjin, China, 1860 to 1960. But before then, thank you so much, Timon, for joining me today.
Pleasure.